Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. Last week, I went to one of our two local hardware stores to buy a light bulb. And like the other one, this had surprisingly slim pickings. As you probably know, incandescent light bulbs are going to be off the shelves as of January 1st, so you'd think there'd be a big array of fluorescent and LED bulbs, but it's a strange transitional moment where that doesn't seem to be happening yet. At any rate, I looked a little puzzled. So this gray-haired clerk, probably about my age, came over and said, well, can I help you? And I told him what I was looking for. And he said, the government's changing the rules here. We can't have any incandescent bulbs because the government doesn't want us to have any. And I said, well, right, but we're having to, the EPA made that ruling so that we could use quite a bit less power. And we had to do that because we couldn't get solar panels on the roof of every home and apartment building and office building in this country during the last 10 years. You'll notice there was no big push to do that, so here we are. And he said, yeah, and they're all made in China, and, you know, that's what all the jobs went to China. I mean, that's what the government wants. And I said, actually, it was the corporations that leaned on the government to rewrite the trade agreements. And that started with the first President Bush when they renegotiated the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. That was all negotiated by corporate people. There were no environmental or labor people at the table. And it was the companies that said to the government, let us take the jobs where the labor is cheaper. This will be really good for American companies. And then it'll therefore generate a lot of taxes for you, and you can just make some job training programs, and all the displaced manufacturing people can train for higher tech jobs. So, I mean, that's how we got the situation we're in with all the jobs, even getting subsidies to be moved over to foreign factories. So it went on like that. There were some pauses between what each of us were saying. And then at the end I said, you know, I've really enjoyed talking with you. And he looked at me and he said, I have too. So that went pretty well. And maybe I moved some marbles around. But even as I was speaking with him, I kept thinking, there was this thought arising in my mind periodically. I bet I could be doing this better. I could probably be doing this better. And so I have been greatly looking forward since that day last week to this interview, because my guest is the author of a new book called Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. So, yes, we all need to learn to do a little better talking across lines, because the situation's pretty grave. And then I noticed online more recently that today's guest recently gave a talk earlier this month, and it had an excerpt from that text in which he really came down hard on a subject that I find immensely exasperating, the fact that most Americans seem to be disinclined to talk about the big physical crises bearing down on us. And here's an excerpt from that talk my guest gave. Quote, let me put this in plain terms. We live in a dead world, not a world that's dying, but a world that is dead, beyond repair, beyond reclamation, perhaps beyond redemption. The modern industrial high-energy/high-technology world is dead. I do not know how long life as we know it in the first world can continue, but the future of our so-called lifestyle likely will be measured in decades, not centuries. Whatever the time frame for collapse, the contraction has begun. The central illusion of the industrial world's extractive economy, propped up by a technological fundamentalism that is as irrational as all fundamentalisms, is that we can maintain indefinitely a large-scale human presence on the Earth at something like the current first world levels of consumption. The task for those with critical sensibilities is not just to resist oppressive social arrangements, but to speak a simple truth that almost no one wants to acknowledge, colon, this high-energy/high-technology life of affluent societies is a dead end. We can't predict with precision how resource competition and ecological degradation will play out in the coming decades, but it is ecocidal to treat the planet as nothing more than a mine from which we extract and a landfill into which we dump. We cannot know for sure what time the party will end, but the party's over. Now, there's a little bit more, but I just want to pause here and say that paragraph, do I agree with that? Certainly. That paragraph or some version of it has shown up in every Green Party platform around the world, 70 parties. It was certainly in the German Party platform in 1983. We can't go on revved up like this and just expecting it to spread and the planet somehow be able to multiply the fish and loaves. It's not going to happen. So what's exasperating for me, as I say, since I can see at the beginning of the book on the copyright page that I have 12 years over this particular author we're going to speak with in a minute, 12 more years than he of an exasperation as an environmental activist, or in my case, an eco-social activist, because that's what green politics is about, bringing together the ecological analysis and the social analysis for an eco-social vision. But, you know, when I read in the New York Times, oh, the head of the Pacific military theater or whatever, you know, has released this report, there are going to be millions of environmental refugees moving, you know, everywhere, and they're going to swamp the systems and put a strain on the state everywhere. And I just look at the paper and I say, we told you that was going to happen. We told you 30 years ago. We told you 20 years ago. The head of the Green Parties in Europe, Sarah Parkin, was invited to speak to the NATO generals, and she told them ecological disruption is going to disrupt security. So they had her a couple times, and they said, oh, yeah, that green stuff, we know that. And now, oh, surprise, we have to put out a special white paper on this. So, yeah, the way this has been swept off the table again and again until we're in a pretty extreme situation now in 2013, it's kind of maddening. Okay, let me finish this little excerpt. Quote, look at any crucial measure of the health of the ecosphere in which we live, groundwater depletion, topsoil loss, chemical contamination, increased toxicity in our own bodies, the number and size of dead zones in the oceans, accelerating extinction of species and reduction of biodiversity, and ask a simple question. Where are we heading? It's easy to cover up our inability to face this by projecting it onto others. When someone tells me, quote, I agree with your assessment, but people can't handle it, unquote, I assume that what the person really means is, I can't handle it. But handling it is, in the end, the only sensible choice. To handle it is to be a moral agent, responsible for oneself and one's place in a community. Mainstream politicians will continue to protect existing systems of power. Corporate executives will continue to maximize profit without concern. And the majority of people will continue to avoid these questions. It's the job of people with critical sensibilities, those who consistently speak out for justice and sustainability, even when it's difficult, not to back away just because the world has grown more ominous. And the speaker ended by citing an observation made by James Baldwin in an essay he published in the New York Times in 1962. Not everything that is faced can be changed. But nothing can be changed until it is faced. That speaker and my guest today is Robert Jensen. You may well have seen some of his articles and editorials at various sites on the internet. I've read a number of substantive pieces by Robert Jensen on the Nation of Change website. He's the author most recently of Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue, and his other books are All My Bones Shake, seeking a progressive path to the prophetic voice, and getting off, colon, pornography and the end of masculinity, and the heart of whiteness, colon, confronting race, racism and white privilege, and citizens of the empire, colon, the struggle to claim our humanity. And last one, writing dissent, colon, taking radical ideas from the margins to the mainstream. He's the co-author with Gail Dines and Anne Russo of Pornography, colon, the production and consumption of inequality. And he's co-editor with David S. Allen of Freeing the First Amendment, colon, critical perspectives on freedom of expression. Robert Jensen is also co-producer of the documentary film, Abe Osheroff, colon, One Foot in the Grave, The Other Still Dancing, which chronicles the life and philosophy of a longtime radical activist. Robert Jensen is a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, teaching courses in journalism, media law, ethics, and politics. He entered academia, earning a PhD in media ethics and law after he'd been a professional journalist for 10 years. In his research, Robert Jensen draws on a variety of critical approaches to media and power. Much of his work has focused on pornography and the radical feminist critique of the cultural links between sexuality and men's violence. He has also addressed questions of race through a critique of white privilege and institutionalized racism. Robert Jensen, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you. Thanks so much.
Well, as I mentioned, I'd like to jump right in and ask you how Americans might become more inclined to discuss the big catastrophic situations we're living through right now, such as global climate disruption and the continuous assault of industrial toxins on humans from the moment of conception on. I mean, I don't know if a lot of people know this, but tests have found that most American babies now have some 200 industrial chemicals in their umbilical cord blood. All those chemicals still largely untested and unregulated.
Yeah.
As for the climate crisis, an astoundingly high percentage of Americans think there's no real problem, that it's simply a matter of corrupt scientists trying to get research grants so they make up this problem, or it's a matter of Democrats running their mouths to have something to posture about. Well, to get to that, how we get people talking about this, I would actually like to talk about your new book, Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue, in the reverse order from the way you arranged the chapters for a general audience, because I think this progressive audience is, I hope, more aware of the planetary and economic crises bearing down on us. So what I'd like to start with is your sense of what's happening right now. What's our situation? Why do we need to move from the age of anxiety to what you call the age of anguish and move into all the things that need to be done now? So would you speak first to your sense of this historical moment for our species and our country, and then a bit later we can go into the conversational skills we need to listen well and respond well to what others are saying?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people, not the majority of the population, but I think a lot of people feel what I call a sense of anxiety over not one's personal problems, but out of the sort of state of the planet, as you're talking about. You know, even people who wouldn't consider themselves politicized or particularly aware of environmental issues, it's kind of hard not to see the trajectory we're on. And not surprisingly, that produces a sense of anxiety. I see it in people all the time. Now, the point I'm trying to make in the book is that you don't resolve that anxiety constructively through the devices the dominant culture gives you, which are, you know, drugs, alcohol, cheap food, lots of entertainment, spectacle, sports. There's a lot of ways the culture will help you dull that anxiety, but the argument I'm making is that the better way, the healthier way, is to recognize that anxiety is an accurate reflection of the state of the planet, and that if we're honest about it, it means that there are no simple solutions. In fact, there probably are no solutions to some of these problems within the structures we currently live. We're talking about the need for truly radical change, systemic change. The possibilities of that don't look very good right now. And so I'm arguing that to embrace anguish isn't to just be depressed. It's to recognize, just as there are reasons to be anxious, there are reasons to look at the situation honestly and realize we're coming to the end of things. And there is a kind of anguish in that. My own view and my own experience is that once I came to the point where I could acknowledge that it wasn't just a problem of educating people to understand the issues, it wasn't just getting to the right policy solution, that there were really some fundamental struggles we faced, and there was no guarantee that we would prevail in them.
Mm-hmm.
The anguish of that actually kind of freed me up to recommit to political organizing and activism. And it may seem counterintuitive, but I'm kind of a happier person once I accepted that anguish. Maybe that's just a reflection of my odd psychology, but I do think others have found that to be true as well. So there's no guarantee, of course, that this kind of argument is going to appeal to a majority of the population. I'm not really speaking in this sense to the dominant culture. I'm speaking to those people who are starting to feel at some level of constant tension with that culture and, mm-hmm. and opening up this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When I read that, we need to move into the age of anguish. I was reading a few lines and I thought, am I missing some connotation here? I better run over to the dictionary and make sure that it means mental or physical pain, which it does. So, of course, there's mental pain in saying, okay, I'm not going to deny it. The water table's overdrawn. The climate patterns are kaput.
Yeah.
This topsoil. I mean, I'm going to look right at it. And I think, that's what you have in mind.
Yeah, exactly. I first started thinking about this probably 20 years ago when a very good friend of mine, an older man who had a lot deeper insight into this than I ever have, he said to me something very profound once. He said, I wake up every morning in a state of profound grief. And again, he wasn't talking about his personal situation. He was talking about his recognition of the death of the systems that currently dominate this planet. And that, I think, is, again, healthy. Now, in a culture that it says, always look on the bright side, there's always solutions, we just have to invent our way into paradise, everything we're talking about is going to go against the grain. And I think the one thing I can say from my own political work and public speaking over the last 10 years is there's a far bigger audience for this kind of discussion than there was 10 years ago. You were talking earlier about how some of these warnings have gone back 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And if you look back earlier, even before that, to the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think people are waking up. Again, I don't want to be naive. It's not a majority of the population of the United States, for instance. But it is considerably larger than it was a decade ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a cause for, if not optimism, which would be misplaced, certainly hope that more and more people want to cope at this level. And then the question is, of course, what do we put our energy into? What kind of projects?
Mm-hmm.
This isn't simply for me a philosophical analysis. This is really about directing our energies in the most appropriate ways. When I say that there probably are no solutions to the problems we face, what I mean, again, is solutions within the current system. And when we recognize that, we can start to direct our efforts to, I think, mostly grassroots organizing. Organizing often at the local level, trying to hook up local experiments on a national and even international level, but really focused on going to ground and trying to create networks, institutions, even physical spaces where we can come together and talk openly and honestly about this. Just to give you an example, in Austin, Texas, where I live, after years of doing organizing around lots of issues, war and peace and labor rights and racial justice, some groups came together, and we decided to invest in a space. We bought a building. We created a community center. We tried to bring into that center people from different kinds of groups, crossing lines of race and ethnicity, of age, trying to create a place where people can come together, not because we all share exactly the same analysis, but because we all share progressive values, and we need that connection. And so even though I'm not a terribly upbeat guy these days, in a way, the last few years have really re-energized me, not because I think we're going to win anytime soon and not because I'm convinced we can win in the long term, but because this is what it means to be a decent human being, to commit to struggles, especially when one is relatively privileged, as many of us in the United States are, especially somebody like me who's a tenured professor and has a lot of options for how to spend my time.
Do you see maybe all those local groups sometime joining forces? Because although I do see a lot can be done at the local level, I also see, you know, well, as I also explained to the man in the hardware store about the government controlling everything, Washington cannot pass a single law that the corporations don't want to see happen.
Yeah.
Because the representatives and the senators are bought and paid for with those big campaign contributions that both parties are desperate to get month after month after month to build up the coffers for the next high-priced media campaign. So every vote is wrong. I mean, you can literally say now the absence of campaign finance reform is literally going to kill us. We should have been cutting carbon emissions back in the 90s when our peers in Europe started doing it in very smart ways. But, of course, our utility corporations and fossil fuel extraction corporations didn't want that to happen, so it didn't happen here. So I do see that a lot can happen locally, but we can't abandon trying to turn things around also on the state and federal level.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, take the problem of money in politics. Even most people in the mainstream recognize that concentrated wealth has dramatically distorted our allegedly democratic political system. Okay, so we've got to initiate campaign finance reform. We've got to sort of change the system somehow so corporate money doesn't dominate. But I would say it's even a more basic struggle than that. It's not just corporate money in politics. It's the nature of the corporation itself. These are extremely hierarchical and profoundly unjust organizations. So we've got to try and delegitimate the corporation, not just get it out of politics, but eventually, I would suggest, get it out of our lives completely. And then we have to realize that it's not just the corporation, that institution, it's the whole capitalist system, which is based on a bizarre notion about unlimited growth on a finite planet and a system that celebrates the worst aspects of human nature. So all of that is, you know, a truly revolutionary agenda, and it's important. And it's also the case that one isn't going to advance that agenda in any, you know, revolutionary sense today. And that's why I think the local is kind of where the action is. As you point out, not because what happens in Washington doesn't matter, but because we don't have a base yet to challenge what's going on in Washington.
That's right.
You know, I think often of historical examples, you know, I think it might have been Mark Twain. If it wasn't Mark Twain, it's probably safe to attribute most pithy sayings to Mark Twain anyway. You know, that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. So that we see patterns in history, not exact replication. And I think if you look at history and take the example of the 1950s. Well, in the 1950s, these problems we faced were important. We were in the midst of anti-communist hysteria, the Cold War, possibility of nuclear annihilation. There was a lot on the table. And it was the case that in the 1950s, challenging that in Washington at the national level was a failed project. The left had no standing at that point to do that. Now, that didn't mean there weren't important political organizing efforts to engage in the 1950s, and people were engaging in them. But it wasn't likely we were going to turn the corner in the 1950s. But the lesson is twofold to me. One is to remember that even when large-scale change isn't possible, there's still a lot of work that can be done to set the stage for that, and you never know when that kind of history is going to shift. And in the 1960s, of course, we saw the culture change quite dramatically. We went from a very locked down kind of society in the 1950s where dissent was repressed to the 1960s where literally every institution, every system in the United States was being challenged, and challenged to a degree that people in power were worried and people in power fought back. Now, the 60s didn't produce the, you know, land of milk and honey that we might have hoped, but it did make significant gains. Those were beaten back to some degree in the beginning in the late 70s and 1980s and continue today to the point where we're fighting just to reclaim some of the space. But that's, you know, the ebb and flow, and that's the struggle. I don't want to be naive or unrealistically optimistic, because I think that produces despair. When one is always promising the moon and then not delivering, people, I think, rightly get despairing. They start to say, well, nothing's possible. So, part of the reason I argue for a fairly limited scope of organizing today, especially at the local level, is so that we keep our expectations in line with reality. Mm-hmm. And then when people do have the experience of success, when people realize that we're competent to run our own lives, then I think that leads to a certain kind of boldness to take additional steps. And nobody can predict where this is going, but I at least see in my own life plenty of reasons to get up every morning and commit a whole lot of my time, energy, and money to not just my own projects, but to collective efforts. And
mm-hmm. Well, what you just said reminded me of Wangari Maathai. That was the way she started that whole democracy movement, kind of inadvertently. She really was interested in reforestation and paying all these women a small amount to plant trees to reforest Kenya. But once they saw what they could accomplish together, then they started looking at why are things the way they are in our society, in the democracy, in the government. And I want to say just a couple more things about that before the break. I want to come back to it in a different way. But also reading your book and listening to you reminded me of three examples, because you point out in two or three places that in our evolutionary history, we passed most of our time, scores of thousands of years, in small bands. And sometimes psychologists say, oh, we've determined that eight people is just the right amount for a book club or a discussion or whatever. But a minimum of eight people is exactly what has worked with the international effort called United Religions Initiative and their program. We had a director on in December, their program called Cooperation Circles. And in every country around the world, people are invited in their community to get together with at least eight people from three different faith traditions and take a look around and see what kind of project needs to be done in their town. And that gets people talking and connecting, and that's been hugely successful. It's self-organizing, and it's really proven to be a dynamic way to organize around the world. And a second example I thought of was when Dolores Huerta told me that early on with the United Farm Workers Union, that she noticed, and other people who did studies noticed, the people who came in from hearing the message at big rallies didn't really stay committed in the movement as long as the people who had heard about it in a living room meeting. They were invited by some neighbor to come into the living room and hear somebody talk about this new farm workers union that was starting up. And those people made a connection with the other people and stayed in it for years. So that difference was interesting. And also I'm thinking of the way back in the peace movement in the early 80s in the Bay Area, we were all organized in affinity groups of at least eight people, in all kinds of different affinities, the Buddhist Peace Fellowship and the Presbyterians for ending nuclear, you know, threat, and certainly a lot of secular orientations. But people making connections like that really furthered the efficacy of the whole corrective effort. So I have to pause here for a break, and then we'll be right back. This is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, Robert Jensen. Let's give them something to talk about, babe. A little mystery to think about. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, Robert Jensen, about his new book, Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. So, as I mentioned before the break, you do point out in a number of places that constitutionally we seem to be comfortable or feel right working in small groups. And I just gave some political examples of that. But as I was reading it, I thought, oh, yes, your book should meet my book, Relational Reality, because it's all about the discoveries in the past decade of what I call relational physiology. And there's a reason we work well in small groups. And I think once this gets out a little more, because it's changing, it's really rippling through all our fields of knowledge, this relational analysis and understanding of how the physical world works. It's not only in physiology and healthcare, but that's where the majority of discoveries have been made. But people will see this is one of the main keys to good health, and they will be drawn even more into finding a neighborhood group to work with. For instance, if you've applied for a life insurance policy recently or long-term care or something like that, you'll see that right on the form it says, do you volunteer regularly? If so, how often? Weekly, twice a month, once a month? Now, the reasons the actuaries at the insurance company want to know that about you is because of all the research showing that people who volunteer regularly have better health and live longer. So I just want to mention a few of these examples in that category because I think it's relevant to trying to understand our profoundly relational nature. There's a pathos that these discoveries are being made only after the year 2000, you know, because our whole medical system, all our systems of knowledge have been based on this biomechanical model, on the mechanistic model. And so now we discover, oops, wrong, it's all about dynamic interrelatedness. Who knew? So here just a couple quick examples. A study of 906 elderly adults found that those with fewer friendships and other social interactions experienced a more rapid decline in motor function, such as walking, gripping, and balancing. Another study of researchers ascertained that for people of all ages, 10 minutes of talking with someone, either in person or even on the phone, boosts mental performance and memory on a test as much as does doing crossword puzzles for 10 minutes before the test. Moreover, it was found that the more social contact people have, the higher their level of mental functioning. And having friends has been found to be a strong preventative factor in avoiding dementia. Here's another one. There was a study reported in the media a year ago last spring. It found that children who are exposed to violence, whether being physically abused or just witnessing violence, especially between ages 5 and 10, experience a shortening of the genetic structure in their cells called the telomeres, which is similar to that seen in the aging process, that shortening. And the more types of violence a child had experienced, the faster his or her telomeres in the cells eroded, shortening their lives, it's estimated, by 7 to 10 years. So, yes, direct or even observed violence in the formative years affects the human body-mind at the cellular level. And in related studies in recent years, it's also been found cross-culturally that spanking lowers IQ. This is relational physiology. So there are so many more here. There are three relational factors that affect how intelligence develops. One's breastfeeding, and it's not just because of the neurosugars, folks. It's because they finally figured out that the hours of interaction between the mother and the nursing infant involve numerous types of relational information being exchanged through the eyes, voice, touch, body language, and this stimulates brain development. And then another one, relational factor that influences the development of intelligence is the amount of language heard in infancy. The greater the number of words young children hear from their parents or caregivers before age three, the higher they score later on intelligence tests and the better grades they get in school. However, their hearing talk on television or a computer screen did not help. In fact, it was detrimental to their skill levels later. So this goes on and on. Relational reality is full of them, but I just want to say we are in the middle of this, what I call a big relational shift in our systems of knowledge, and it absolutely supports what Robert Jensen is advising. You know, we can really get more done to turn things around if we do work in small groups at the local level, and then we'll see where that takes us. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, none of this should be surprising given our evolutionary history.
Was missed for a long time because of the mechanistic worldview.
You know,
we had blinders on.
Right. Well, we tend to privilege or focus on, you know, what we call history, which is the period of human history where we have records and can reconstruct stories.
Right.
But remember that most of human history was lived before writing, before, you know, records, and that this is what we typically call prehistory, but is the bulk of our experience on this planet. And those were small band-level gathering and hunting societies, probably no bigger than 100, 150 at the maximum is sort of the size of a workable group, which means that we evolved in these kinds of relationships based on this kind of interaction. So it's hardly surprising that we flourish in it. You know, that's why in small groups you don't need bureaucracy, you don't need quite as many rules, is because we have ways of working things out. So, you know, that's not a solution to every problem we have. We now live in nation states of hundreds of millions of people. We live on
right.
a planet with 7 billion people. None of this is to suggest, as you're clearly not suggesting, that somehow we can go back to some, you know, mythical golden age of human, small-scale human existence. There's just not enough room on the planet for that. So it's the question of whether or not these things inform the way we organize our institutions. I'm in education, so the first thing that suggests is that the way we do education in the modern industrial world is literally insane, that the way we shove kids into school settings and put them in rows of desks, you know, it's all crazy. And you know, that's even pretty well known. The teachers can tell you that in a second, that the way we organize our educational system is not productive. So all of this simply, I think, leads us to a rather disturbing conclusion, which is the ways we organize ourselves in the contemporary world are unsustainable. They're also in fundamental tension with the kind of beings we are. And what's so funny about
that is
that especially the apologists for capitalism tell you that the way we've organized a capitalist economy is the way that speaks to our nature. You know, we're greedy, self-interested people. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm occasionally greedy and self-interested. So is every other human being I've ever met. But the question is that the dominant part of our nature, or are there other aspects of human nature that, when allowed to flourish, can be equally, if not more, powerful? And the answer to that is clearly yes. But we live in systems that now reward hierarchy, reward a kind of almost deep denial of the nature of the human presence in the larger living world. You know, we literally live in systems that are insane. And that's a hard thing for people to, I think, cope with, to wake up one day and say, literally almost every system around me is based on values that I can't accept, on premises that turn out to be false, and are leading us over the cliff.
I think a hopeful thing is that, I mean, I totally agree that realizing we're far more relational than mechanistic is the way we organize institutions, as you say. But it also, the reason it's changing all our systems of knowledge, it changes the way we analyze problems. It changes
sure.
the way we look at a situation. So the quality of our knowledge now we can see is dependent on the extent to which we can recognize the dynamic interrelatedness in the situation, there are all kinds of relationships. They're always in play. Every cell in our body's in play. I'm in play with you in this conversation and with everybody listening. Everything's in this state of play and becoming. It's not static. And so to go into a problematic situation, an international treaty or a neighborhood dispute, you need to first try to pick up on all the dynamic interrelationships. And I think, you know, when you're saying people realize the systems are so dysfunctional because they're based on keeping that out. They're based on the, okay, where are the basic facts? A, B, C, static categories here. What do we do now? And you can sort of see if you bring in, just keep bringing in more awareness of the dynamic relations, that this could really be nudged off center so that the not only healthier but more realistic way of understanding what's going on could come to the fore. At least that's my hope.
Yeah. And there are places where one can experiment with this. For instance, to make it very concrete, we live in an economy dominated by the corporate form, hierarchical, an owner or owners who hire managers to run a business in which people at the bottom have virtually no power. We might have input, you know, the boss might listen to us, but we have no power to affect the direction of the organization. Well, is that the only way to organize a business? Even is that the only way to organize a business within capitalism? Well, of course not. I'm part of a group in Austin that helps people who want to start worker-owned, worker-run businesses, or what are traditionally called worker cooperatives. Well, that's based on the idea that the people who work should own, that people can self-manage. Now, it again, I want to make it very clear, isn't based on some naive notion that people are perfectible or that we're all really nice at heart. Every human being I've ever met is some combination of really quite noble and lovely characteristics and some pretty nasty characteristics. So we want to build institutions that draw on the best of us, and worker cooperatives can do that. You know, we've had two or three great successes here in Austin in the last couple of years launching businesses by people who previously had been in very, you know, abusive, hierarchical kinds of corporate settings and are now running their own businesses, a bakery, a cleaning cooperative, a brewery. That's evidence, along with the hundreds of cooperatives around the world, thousands around the world, actually, that this is a way we can organize ourselves. And when people in power say, well, you know, ordinary folks aren't capable of doing that, well, all our experience argues the other way, that when you create systems where people can take control of their own lives, and you create the sense that it is possible, then guess what? People do it. And I think that's where we have to, again, look at solutions that come from the grassroots and then use those experiences to scale up, in a sense. And I think worker cooperatives are simply one example of lots of successful experiments that are going on around the world.
You know, that was one of the heartbreaking aspects after the fall of the Soviet bloc from 1989 on, because there was a lot of research on what you were just talking about. And so we were all hoping that the governments who had succeeded, that is the, you know, opposition who would now be in power, could further this formation of a lot of workers' cooperatives. But instead, the corporate powers just rushed in to those countries with all their advisors, and I saw some of the brochures that were printed up, and they just said, oh, congratulations, you're a democracy. That automatically means laissez-faire corporate capitalism. Whoopee, here we go.
Yeah, there were two great, you know, lost opportunities at the end of the Cold War. One was at the level of the international system and the creation of a less violent world. We used to talk about the peace dividend after end of the Cold War, and that was, of course, an opportunity lost, in large part because the United States decided that in the absence of the, you know, the Cold War, and I always thought the Cold War was a bit of a kind of a sham to, you know, rationalize very disproportionate levels of power by the U.S., but that peace dividend was squandered when people decided at the highest levels of our government they didn't actually want a democratic world. And at the economic level, the same thing. Without the so-called communist threat, we could have explored different ways of organizing ourselves, not in the traditional capitalist mode, but also not in the traditional state socialist mode, which had failed
right.
quite dramatically. And that
right.
was squandered, too.
Right.
You know, that might have been a turning point in human history. Maybe things that were possible in 1989 are no longer. It's hard to tell, but we do have to recommit to the things we know can work. And what we know can work, as you're pointing out, is organizations where people have feel and do have a stake in the organization, where they feel as if their input
That's right.
matters, where they have actual power instead of just basically serving as cogs in the machine.
Right. Okay. Well, we're out of time now, but I want to recommend to everyone Robert Jensen's book, Arguing for Our Lives. There's a chapter in here, I'm sure you'll find healthy, a section called False Alternatives. So the next time someone says to you, it's either environmental protection or jobs, whip out your Robert Jensen and you can make your informed response there. So, Robert Jensen, thank you so much for coming on the program.
It was a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's amble over to the Arts Corner and see what we have there this week. For our poem, we have a new one by Galway Cannell, which I happened to see in The New Yorker a few weeks ago. He's still cooking artistically at age 86. How inspiring. This is a deep poem entitled The Silence of the World. I can imagine the silence when the world will have stilled itself. No more poems tossed off the tongue. No more screams of raven lugging entrails of porcupine. No more tales of the Navajo or Louisiana black man or old-time Vermonter. No more breathing in the ear of last lover. No more angelic beings left to be kissed in the claustrophobia of flesh. No more temples giving light from open doors into bitter winter nights. No more curious weasel who leaves her black ring frozen in the air. No more tooth that gnaws through gum and bones into the cathedral of the mouth. No more splat when singer spits mouthwash into the wash basin after the concert. No more, quit your ballin' from punk principal to slob schoolboy when sore mother hauls small boy into classroom by sore ear. No more young woman in large hat in profile in afternoon light saying, so what, darling? I don't hate you. I love you. So what? No more flutesmen trudging through snow on 125th Street on the last Sunday morning of his jeopardy. No more husband saying, snack bar's the other way. No more wife replying, you aren't going to eat again, are you? No more husband replying, I don't want to eat. I was just telling you where the snack bar is. No more wife replying, for Christ's sake, I know where it is. No more caesura or everything one endless caesura. No more feminine rhyme such as lattice and thereat is. No more paralismus memoramrum panting in one ear. No more Neruda's slowly deepening voice saying, Federico, tu acuerdas debajo de la tierra. From across the valley, the thud of an axe arrives later than its strike, and the call of goodbye slowly separates itself, little by little, from the vocal cords of everything. That was Galway Cannell. Our song this week is to remind you that tomorrow is the summer solstice, beginning around 1 o'clock a.m. tonight Eastern time. So we'll hear Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong performing Summertime from Porgy and Bess. Here it is.
Thank you. Don't you say